Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats. The show is about to begin.
Noah was a drunk. Look what he accomplished. And no one's even asking you to build an ark. All you have to do is go to New Jersey and visit a small church on a very important day. Hello, and welcome to Three Guys in a Flick. This is where we review the good, the bad, and the absurd. Tonight's episode, Dogma. Beware, spoilers. Coming to you live again from my basement, my name is Don. I am the host. With me tonight, to my right, is John, our comic book and web guy.
Snoochie Boochies.
And to my left, the professor, Ken.
Good evening.
How you guys doing?
Doing good.
Yep.
It's Dogma night.
Yeah. Glad to see you guys. Dogma was released May 21st, 1999 at Cannes, November 12th, 1999 in the U.S., and it was written and directed by Kevin Smith.
Amazing guy. I love Kevin Smith. He gets the comic book person. He is a comic book collector and lover.
And I think he's a great storyteller.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I really enjoy Kevin Smith.
If you ever get a chance to see Kevin Smith live, when he presents one of his movies, take part in it and definitely go do it. We got to go see, was it Silent Bob and Jay Strike Back?
The reboot.
The reboot. We got to go see him present that. Kevin Smith with Jason Mewes. It was just amazing to hear him tell his stories.
I could sit and listen to that guy talk for hours upon hours upon hours.
He's a great storyteller. Yeah.
If you ever get the chance, you should check out An Evening with Kevin Smith. Mm-hmm. A movie he did.
The Prince story?
Yeah. The Prince, the Batman.
Yeah.
All of it. It's so entertaining. Yeah. All right. So Dogma is about an abortion clinic worker with a special heritage who is called upon to save the existence of humanity from being negated by two renegade angels who are trying to exploit a loophole and re-enter heaven.
How'd this movie do, Don?
Not too bad, John. It did $44 million at the box office and only cost $10 million to make, so Kevin Smith is pretty happy about that.
Yeah, for all right. the bad PR and protests that he got, that's a pretty good showing.
Yeah, yeah. What'd you think? Do you think it was in bad taste?
I don't know if you could say it was in bad taste. It certainly raises your eyebrows in a religious sense, because it is pushing hard on the boundaries of bedrock beliefs that people have had for a millennia.
Absolutely. Yeah. What about you?
I went into it just enjoying the film.
Yeah. Just a big Kevin Smith fan.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't have any rock hard, beliefs that were being violated.
Well, that's good. I mean, you have to have a sense of humor, right? No matter what you believe in, if it really bothered you, then you wouldn't watch it. Right.
Yeah. So. I didn't think that it was putting down the Catholic Church.
It might have poked fun a little bit, especially with the Buddy Christ and the
Cardinal.
It was a clever take on it, I thought.
The whole movie seemed to center around the plot of, don't focus on the belief, focus on the idea.
Yeah.
And question ideas and come up with new ideas. And so it was kind of challenging people's beliefs in saying, here's some new ideas to think about.
Right. So growing up Catholic, it never dawned on me that Jesus went from, 12 to 33?
Right.
In, two pages, as they say it. And what Kevin Smith came up with, wherever he got it, it's kind of funny. I've found some humor in it, but I have a sense of humor. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, he'd been writing this movie for a long time. They said that he even had this movie written before he wrote Clerks, because this was his passion project, but he could never get anybody interested in because it was so controversial.
Well, and he wanted to wait until he could afford proper effects.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, after watching it last night on DVD, those effects don't really hold up.
No, they do not.
But, 99, and hey, God bless him for trying.
I think the only thing that the Catholic Church probably would have had a real beef with, in my opinion, was them casting George Carlin.
An atheist.
I think that they looked at that. I base that off of nothing. But I think that is a chafing point.
Well, most of the protests from the Catholic Church were by people who hadn't seen the movie.
Isn't that ironic?
Yeah.
Don't you think?
Yeah. Foreshadowing.
A lot of people were like that for the Harry Potter series.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
That was witchcraft and demonology.
That hadn't read the books, hadn't seen the movies.
Mm-hmm. Da Vinci Code was another one, I think, that got a lot of that.
Oh, yeah. Very much so.
We move on into... We've just met, you know, our characters at the airport, the two angels, and now we're in our main character Bethany's bedroom as she meets Metatron, if I can say that name correctly. Metatron, the voice of God, who puts her on her mission. What did you guys think of Alan Rickman coming in at that scene with the big fire and everything, how that all worked out?
I enjoyed it. I thought that, you know, him being pissy about God, you know, when he was complaining about the fire extinguisher. But, you know, how many times did he say it and how long were the flames going on for? What were you expecting?
Yeah.
And what would you do if a big fire burst out into your, even if it's a talking fire, but a big fire in your bedroom?
What Bethany did, go grab a fire extinguisher and put out the flaming ball of fire at the foot of my bed.
And according to, you know, Metatron, used a whole can. He's basically there to put her on a holy mission from her deity that she now has to go and stop two angels from re-entering this church.
You know what I loved about that scene is that she kept questioning him. Are you sure you are who you are? And he kept saying things like, well, don't let the wings fool you.
Well, as we learned earlier, she's had a crisis of faith.
Yeah.
She had apparently something happened to her womb. She can no longer have children. And she lost her belief in God. Mm-hmm. And now this angel is visiting her in her bedroom. So, of course, what the hell?
Yeah, but he's got wings.
He's got wings.
He turned her bat into a fish.
And no junk.
And no junk. He's anatomically correct like
Kendall.
Yeah.
First part, she's got to go meet the prophets.
Yeah, she needs to seek out the prophets.
Enter Jay and Silent Bob.
They come in as the prophets. They save her from an attack.
Yeah, and the big play on this is that Jay mentions at one point that they should go back home to New Jersey and make some profit.
If you're unfamiliar with anything Kevin Smith, Jay and Silent Bob tend to have a reoccurring role in all of his films.
Was this their first big role? Because I seem to recall before that, this was before Jay and Silent Bob. The first movie came out.
Yeah.
So before that, they were just kind of background characters who would speak every so often. Maybe Mallrats, they had a little bit of a bigger role in. But this was the first one where they were kind of the center of the movie. The way I think of it is, we're now building the fellowship, if I can quote Lord of the Rings. and these are the two, you know, dwarves now coming in to join the team.
So Jay and Silent Bob are the dwarves?
Yeah, well, Jason Mewes is more like, I think, was he more like the elf and Silent Bob would be the dwarf?
So Jay and Silent Bob and Bethany meet. They are on the road. And they're
now on their mission.
They're now on their mission. They're driving down the road and their car breaks down.
Because?
Because Jay can't drive?
Yeah, they let Jay drive, but he doesn't know how to drive. So he doesn't know how to work a manual car and doesn't shift it into any gears.
Right. Classic Jay and Silent Bob.
Yeah.
Right. And of course, Silent Bob doesn't say anything.
This is all a setup, obviously, to get them broken down on the side of the road to introduce our next character.
Who is Rufus, the 13th apostle, played by
Chris Rock.
Yeah. And I thought he did an amazing job in this movie.
Oh, he's hilarious.
Yeah. Do you know that originally he wanted Samuel Jackson to play Rufus?
Oh, I could see that too. I could see it going either way, mm-hmm. for sure.
I think the character would have been pretty different. I think it would have been more of a kind of a Pulp Fiction type Samuel Jackson versus Chris Rock's a little more lighthearted.
Well, I'm pretty sure Chris Rock is younger. Yeah. And that's what they were going for.
Mm-hmm.
Samuel Jackson would have had too much wisdom over everything because he's Samuel Jackson.
Now, what do you think about Chris Rock's character, Rufus, being brought in? It seemed to me like his main point was to bring in the questioning aspect of everything.
Oh, sure.
You know, like all of a sudden we have a 13th apostle when, you know, you guys know, you know, the Catholic religion a little bit better than I do. I believe there's only supposed to be 12. Is that correct?
Yep.
So now we've got a 13. He brings up the fact that he was left out because he's black.
Yeah. And I love how he says Jesus was black. Bethany says, how come he's in the Bible and you're not? And Chris Rock says, it's kind of hard to have your story without your hero.
So for me personally, I look at Jesus as he was probably pretty dark skinned. And I think all of the apostles, they were not white.
Yeah.
None of them were white by a long shot.
But Chris Rock does call them all white.
So whether or not Kevin Smith is playing a racial card, eh.
I don't know where he's getting all of this. I don't know if he's making it up. I don't know if there's conspiracy theories out there that says that you are missing pages from the Bible.
Which gets me wondering, why was this story written in the first place? Because it's got a lot of content to it. And this content, it all is driven from somewhere because he digs up a lot.
Well, I think it goes back, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think it goes back to him wanting people to question everything. So just even right there, he brings up a question and topic for debate, was Jesus white or black? Were the apostles white or black? Mm-hmm. And was there a 13th apostle? Was there anybody who was possibly left out because they didn't fit the mold that the people who wrote the Bible were going for?
Maybe. But now we're opening up a whole other
Very much so, because there's a ton of content that was, you know, questioned. Is this going in or is this out? In, out, in, out. And there's a lot of it.
And everything that Kevin Smith does in this film, or everything that he wrote about, it makes sense. Mm-hmm. Right? If you think about it logically, story holds weight. You believe it.
We've now got Rufus joining the group, joining the fellowship.
Yep.
I don't know if he would be another elf or if he would be.
He's almost Gandalf.
Yeah, oh, right? You're right. I'll bet you he is the Gandalf character. But anyway, he's joined the fellowship. They're now on their journey.
They go to movies first. Oh. And this is, if you're talking about Kevin Smith and the View Askew universe, this is the introduction of movies, and it's a reoccurring theme throughout his films. And I thought it was brilliant when he brings it back, because I'm just a big fan of Kevin Smith. Let's talk about these renegade angels real quick.
Okay.
Okay. They are played by Ben Affleck and Matt Damon. They're in everything together.
Yeah.
Especially in the 90s.
Ben plays Bartleby and Matt Damon plays Loki.
Yeah, the Angel of Death.
Now, this is the weirdest thing to me, because I'm a big fan of mythology, and I know that Rufus brings up that he doesn't like it when you call him mythology.
Right.
But I love mythology from all different types. I read actually a lot of mythology, from Russian mythology, from Norse mythology to Greek mythology. I read it all. I even read, the Bible stories.
Jewish mythology?
Well, that would also be the Bible stories. But yeah, Yiddish mythology. Old Testament, New Testament. I read all of that. And the interesting thing I had was, why Kevin Smith, and I couldn't find a good reason for it, why he named the Angel of Death Loki and the demon Azrael. Because if you follow mythology, most Bible stories has Azrael as the name of the Angel of Death. And Loki is Norse mythology for the trickster. The only reason I could come up with is that beginning scene with Matt Damon, where he talks the nun out of, believing in her religion, that he talks her into believing that there is no God when he knows there is a God.
Yeah.
And so he's a trickster at that point. He's become, he's gone from the Angel of Death to kind of being a trickster.
Maybe.
What do you think?
And maybe he just liked the name Loki, I guess.
Quick trivia question for you.
Yes, sir.
This is the first movie that Matt Damon has played Loki. What Ragnarok. Is the other movie?
Next question.
You could have given it just a second. Yes, he played Loki in Ragnarok as well.
Yeah, ironically.
Yes.
So what'd you think of Affleck and Damon as these angels?
In general, I found them to be very young. I found the acting to be rough around the edges. I'm not used to seeing them like that.
Yeah. I thought that they worked well together. I liked the story that was laid out in front of us. We learned that they are banished to Wisconsin for all of eternity. And then at the end of the world, they have to sit outside the gates.
For the rest of eternity.
Yeah. Yeah. And why? Why do they have to do that?
Because they got drunk one night after Loki had gone and killed all the firstborn in Egypt. They got drunk one night, and Bartleby talked Loki into laying down his sword, not killing anymore, and basically Loki gave the middle finger to God.
Yeah, and so they got banished to Wisconsin.
Not only that's
good writing. I like that.
Not only that, ruined it for all other angels in their kind that they could no longer imbibe alcohol.
Right. Hence all the spitting.
Yeah. Bartleby has received a piece of mail that has a news clipping in there revealing that a church is, and I don't remember what they call that rule, that they're establishing a rule based off of old church dogma law that says that anybody who passes through these church doors is instantly forgiven for all of their sins. So they basically come out with a clean slate. So the angels feel like they can go to this church, basically cutting their wings off, becoming human, and pass through the doors with a clean slate and go back to heaven. So they've found a loophole to get around God's will.
Right.
But as Metatron revealed, God is infallible, and if you prove him wrong, it will undo all of creation because all creation is based on the fact God can't be wrong.
Right.
So that's basically the whole mission. Well, these angels don't care about that. They just want to get back into heaven. They're right. Tired of Wisconsin.
Right. So Loki has this idea to get back on God's good graces that he needs to rid the world of the Mubi Corporation for being too
gaudy. The idolaters.
Yeah, yes.
With the fecalator, the gun that he goes and purchases.
Yeah. All right. So while this is all going on, Jane, Silent Bob, and
Rufus and Bethany, they all go to the strip club.
They all go to the strip club to prove that Jay's not gay.
Yep. And we're introduced to a new character. Ken, do you remember who the new character is?
Yes, I do, actually. Selma Hayek playing Serendipity. The fun thing about Selma Hayek is something that my wife doesn't necessarily enjoy as much, is that I have a big soft spot for Selma Hayek. She is.
The joke that I would insert here is I have a hard spot for her, but I'm not going to say that.
Well, you just did.
Sorry, Julie.
And so, you know, see Candy Girl going on? Okay.
Candy Girl by New Edition. Great song. So Selma Hayek.
The glasses. Yay or nay?
Oh, yay.
I thought the glasses just made
and the
that scene.
And the pigtails.
Yeah, and the pigtails. Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I thought she was fantastic. She played that role amazing.
So you're saying she plays an amazing stripper?
Yeah.
Yeah, well.
Well, she plays inspiration.
Oh, well done, sir.
So she was inspiring.
Well played. Well played. Yeah, so she is serendipity, inspiration, and she's inspiring Jay and Silent Bob in a bidding war with the gang members on the other side of the stage when Rufus and Bethany walk in and Rufus recognizes her, right? And mm-hmm. So that's a cute little exchange.
It's like the muse.
Yeah.
But then we are visited by our first demon. Do you remember what the demon was called?
Oh, the Golgothan?
Golgothan, the shit right. demon.
Right. So the Golgothan was summoned by Azrael, who's played by Jason Lee. Probably one of my favorite characters in this movie.
What did you think of the casting of Jason Lee as Azrael?
I thought it was brilliant. I heard that he wanted to do Loki's part. Mm-hmm. He wanted to do Matt Damon's part. But due to scheduling conflicts, he had to take on Azrael. Azrael is a demon from the depths of hell, and he is the one who actually inspires Bartleby and Loki to go on their journey. So he's actually at the bottom of all of this, so yes. to speak.
He knows, we find out a little bit later, he knows that this will end all of creation, will end everything, but he'd rather it all end than go back to hell.
Right.
And we find out a little bit later, too, that he wasn't always a demon. He was originally a muse, just like Serendipity.
Yeah, he was an artist.
Yes, but he chose not to fight in the great war between heaven and hell, right. or between Lucifer's forces. And
he was a fence-sitter.
Yeah, he was cast out.
So now we know that Azrael is the true villain of the story, and he has sent these angels on their quest, and now they're on their way to New Jersey. And at the same time, so is Bethany and gang.
Going back to the bar scene with the Golgotham.
Gothan.
Golgothan. And how they showed off camera, the Golgothan beat the heck out of all the gang members.
Right.
And they're trying to figure out how they're going to fight him. Serendipity's putting together a Molotov cocktail, I think, at the point. And Kevin Smith's Silent Bob stands up, sprays something in his mouth, which is what, air freshener,
mm-hmm.
that knocks out strong smells.
Right.
What do you think? Was that a little corny to you?
Well, yeah, but I mean, the whole, it didn't take me out of the story. I thought it was very Silent Bob-ish. The way he is portrayed in the movies, even like in Mallrats, he's kind of comic relief. And so I didn't think that it didn't bother me.
What about you?
I thought it was funny.
Did you? I felt it was a little Bugs Bunny to me.
Yeah. My word is trite.
Trite.
Mm-hmm.
Would you have liked that scene to be a little more drawn out, or would you just glad that it was over quick?
Glad that it was over quick.
Okay. I mean, it was a shit demon, so it was kind of nasty.
Are you talking about the whole scene, or are you talking about...
I was expecting them to kind of have like a fight with him or do something to defeat the demon, and all he does is get up and spray something in his mouth and knock him out, and that we're done with the Golgotham after this big buildup.
Yeah, well, it's a Kevin Smith movie.
Okay.
It's not Peter Jackson.
Yeah. Well, I'm still building my fellowship.
Yes. Yes, you are.
So Serendipity joins the fellowship.
She actually stays behind to question the Golgothan. We will see Serendipity a tad bit later.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So now, our heroes are on their way to New Jersey and the angels are on their way to New Jersey. And ironically, or, very craftily written, end up on the same train.
I think, as you would usually say, because it's written that way.
Because it's movie convenience is what it's I like
movie
to
convenience.
Say. So all of our subjects are on the train. You
know, Bethany and Bartleby are having this deep discussion about faith and religion and relationships. And over with Silent Bob and Jay and Loki, they're just getting stoned.
Well, Loki can't get stoned.
I know, he's faking it.
Yeah, do you notice he fakes the motions of it?
I liked that you could see that they all get along. They could have all been friends. They could have, you know, it's that whole thing of not knowing where each other's coming from that... There's a spark there. I mean, there are two angels deep down aren't bad guys. They're both like you get from Bartleby's standpoint in that he's deeply hurt by the rejection of God. And that to him, that almost matches Bethany's deep hurt when, you know, she basically lost the ability to have children and her husband left her because of that.
Right.
So she got, you know, rejected by her husband and in a way felt like she was rejected by God because of the way that she was damaged. And Bartleby is the same thing. You know, they both agree that, you know, people always say the hurt gets less over time, but really it gets worse.
Yeah. Yeah. And the way he tells the story and they sit there and it's a good moment. It's well written. And then Rufus, who was taking a nap, wakes up, walks into the car and notice Bartleby right away, and they have an exchange.
Everybody understands who each other really is.
Right. And it turns out that Bethany is the last Zion.
Well, before that, real quick, when Rufus wakes up, he says something. Did you catch what he said?
No.
He apparently said poopy trim. And I guess that was a line that is also used in Mallrats. Brody says it at one point when he's lurched out of kind of a daydream, I guess, in the mall. He says poopy trim real quick. So they just worked that into this movie.
Really? I'm going to have to rewatch that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love Mallrats. Mallrats is a great flick. Rufus confronts Bartleby, and all the roles and players are kind of fleshed out. Bartleby and Loki find out that Bethany is the last Zion sent to kill them, and Rufus obviously is the 13th apostle, is helping them. They have kind of a tussle, and then
and I'm sorry, this is going to sound stereotypical, but they have their Mexican standoff.
Yeah, they...
Basically, Bartleby's got a knife. Or no, he's got the broken glass to broken Bethany's neck. And they kind of have their whole little talk of, you know this is wrong, you know this is what will happen, but they don't care.
Right, right. So Silent Bob to the rescue, throws him off the train. And this is one of only two lines for Silent Bob here.
A total of three words he says in the whole movie.
Yeah.
Two of the words happen here.
Yeah. No ticket.
Yes.
That's his line.
Yeah. Yes. Which is hearken to?
Immediately. Raiders of the Lost Ark and Last Crusade.
Yep.
This is where we have that moment with the two angels after they get thrown off. Bartleby is snapped. He doesn't care anymore. Loki's kind of freaking out. He's like, they got the last Zion on us? Maybe we didn't really think this through. And
I thought it was interesting. This is where Bartleby, he now has someone to blame. Before, you know, as he put it, you know, his relationship with God was broken up over, you know, talking Loki into laying down a sword, but no longer that anymore. It's when humanity came into the picture.
Yeah.
So now he blames humanity for all of his problems and doesn't care if they get blinked out of existence.
Yeah. He's jealous, mm-hmm. is what he is. He
says, angels have done all the heavy lifting, and then here come human beings doing nothing, ruining everything, and they're more important to God.
Well, and again, this is a great bit of writing because everything that he's saying, it makes sense. Right. And he says, you know, he created humans and they get to choose mm-hmm. whether they believe in him or not. You know, we never got that choice. We were always to obey and serve, you know.
And the moment that he didn't obey was the moment that they got cast out.
Yeah. And he said that, you know, God has infinite amount of patience with human beings. And he asks Loki one time to lay down the sword. And nope. He says, where was his infinite fucking patience then? Right? Mm-hmm. So he's very upset. So now he's ready to go home by any means necessary, and which would mean, you know, the end of existence.
I kind of liked this back and forth between them because I believe this is the part where Loki calls him out and says, I've heard this tone before.
Yeah, and then he gets heard, all...
this is the same, you know, tone that the Morning Star had, that Lucifer had.
Yeah, and Bartleby immediately knows what... Loki is saying, and he's saying, shut up, right? Mm-hmm. Don't say it, because he knew it was coming.
Yeah. What do you think?
Great scene.
What do you think of this interaction between the two?
We're talking about in the underground car.
Parking lot area.
Yeah, in the underground parking lot. I understand the dialogue. I understand why the dialogue is necessary. I did not like the way that they delivered it. Ben Affleck was better, but Matt Damon, he felt more juvenile in his delivery, and it took me out of the moment. In what was supposed to be transcribed to us. Matt Damon, in general, he's got a million-dollar smile. And I feel like I see that million-dollar smile many times throughout the movie when I don't think that the scenes call for it. And this is one of those times when I felt like that how he delivered it, I just wasn't as engaged with it. I also was slightly, how the dialogue was written, I felt like, for me, the dialogue didn't flow. This is oversimplifying it, but I just didn't like how it was expressed through the writing for this scene.
Yeah. As a director, Don, you're delivering to these two actors their inspiration for these lines. Mm-hmm. Would you say, I would think that Kevin Smith probably told Ben Affleck, the way it feels to me, you are a jealous boyfriend. You know, you are basically all upset that you've been dumped by this girl, or jealous ex-boyfriend. You've been dumped by this woman, and now you're finding someone to blame. And then I would have told Matt Damon, you're seeing your friend out of control and you got to talk him off the ledge.
Yeah.
Would you see this as kind of maybe how Kevin Smith inspired them?
Possibly, you know, it's hard to tell. If it were me, I kind of read it. I read Ben Affleck's performance in the scene as more of a pouty child, right? He was the favorite. Now he's not the favorite anymore. And he's jealous and he's still, you know, very bitter. Over it, what does he say? Over a millennia they've been in mm-hmm. Wisconsin. So, but I understand what you're saying, Ken, is you see Ben Affleck and Matt Damon on screen, and 9 times out of 10, you see Ben Affleck and Matt Damon on the screen and not necessarily the characters. And for me, I think luckily this was early in, this was as they were becoming Ben Affleck and Matt Damon. And looking back on it now, it's hard not to see that. It didn't take me out as much just because I knew what I was getting with them. And I thought they played very well off each other. I thought the dialogue was written well. And even though he does come off as a pouty child, I mean, that's his motivation. You know, that he's mm-hmm. they're going to go to New Jersey and they're going to get it done regardless. So,
at this point, they both definitely know the repercussions of what happens if they go in and out of the church.
Yeah. So now everybody's all in.
Right.
Yeah.
And we have to have this dialogue to understand what's at stake.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And we now have everything, all the players set in place, everything, the motion for our big end game.
Yeah. So now, now we're moving to the end game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, if they get in and out of church, we're getting the Thanos snap.
Probably worse than that, because at least with, well, definitely worse. It's all existence.
Yeah.
Thanos was only
half 100% instead of 50.
Yeah.
So we move on from the underground scene. We move on from the train. We go to the campfire scene where Bethany finally learns her real heritage and why she was chosen to go on to this mission and what it means to be the last Scion.
Right. And we find out that she's the great, 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 great grandniece of Jesus Christ. You talked about corny moments in the film. I thought this one was more corny than Silent Bob with his poop spray.
Like the whole scene or just when she goes and throws her tantrum?
No, the fact that she was the great, 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 great grandniece of Jesus Christ.
Well, what did you
think? I don't know why. I don't know.
From both of your viewpoints, what do you think of the idea that Jesus may have had siblings?
I think it's entirely reasonable.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I thought that was very well put in the way Chris Rock even explains it.
And Metatron brings that explanation home.
I mean, they even bring up the fact, you know, when Chris Rock, Rufus is explaining it, that yes, Mary had not been touched by a man when she bore Jesus, but she was still a married woman. Right. Do you think that she never got down with her husband, you know, after that point?
I found it interesting and plausible. It was a good plot point that moved us forward. I just thought that the fact that she was his grandniece was, it was just a little hokey to me, but whatever. Mm-hmm. It didn't fully take me out of it, but you were talking about those moments where, what did you call it?
Oh, a Bugs Bunny moment.
Yeah.
Kind of the Bugs Bunny moment where it's a moment of convenience that they just pull out some wacky item and they fix the problem.
And that's kind of what this moment was for me.
Yeah.
This reveal, I should say.
Well, at least the spray didn't have Acme written on it.
That's true.
That is true.
But we don't know for sure that he didn't read the label.
No.
She finds out who she really is. She's accepted the mission.
Well, she throws her tantrum in the lake, which I didn't like the tantrum. I thought the tantrum was a bit much. I understand she could be upset and it's a lot to take on and she could be overwhelmed. But that whole scene just bothered me with her splish splashing in the water. And
I was gonna say something, but I can't, and so all I will say, John, is I'm sure you don't understand.
Linda Florentino.
Yes.
What did you think of her?
Looking back on it now and watching it again like we did last night, I kind of thought the same thing. She was, for me, she was kind of just there. I didn't really care.
Well, originally, Alanis Morissette was supposed to play Bethany, but her schedule didn't work out. And Kevin Smith went on to say that she was very hard to work with, this Linda person, Linda's actress. She was, they had a lot of problems. They didn't talk on set. After the filming was done, they didn't talk at all until Kevin Smith had his heart attack. That's where they kind of mended their fences. And Kevin Smith had even said during an interview, which I think really upset her, that he wished he had cast Janine Garofalo as Bethany.
That would have been interesting.
And I hate to say it, but I think Janine Garofalo would have done a better job.
I do too.
Yeah, so do I.
I agreed. I found Linda to be, I did not appreciate her interpretation of the role. In general, I found her visual cues, her facial expressions to be off-putting. I didn't agree with how she was interpreting that. Counterpoint. I could not get enough of, and I will always love, Silent Bob and his facial expressions. He is spot on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He gives a ton of emotion, and you know exactly where he is with his facial expressions. He completely sells what he needs to sell.
And Silent Bob has been breaking the fourth wall long before Deadpool ever did. Mm-hmm. So every once in a while, he'll glance at the camera. He'll spike the camera, and it goes into those perfect facial expressions, right? He's master at it.
My biggest issue with Linda is that usually you have your comedic talents and you have your straight man. You know, the person kind of play off of each other. She didn't play off very well against, you know, with the comedy. It didn't bounce off her very well.
Yeah.
It wasn't believable.
Agreed. There's a lot of scenes where she's talking, especially to Jay and Silent Bob, because Jay is continually trying to have sex with her. She doesn't have any reaction to what he's saying. Mm-hmm. She's very blah. And then in other moments, like that freak out moment that we're talking about, she overacts it.
Yeah.
You know, in my opinion, but then again, who am I?
And kind of what you were saying, Ken, earlier, there's no facial expressions. I mean, it's the same almost expression in every scene.
Yeah. So it's a consensus. Three of us, not a huge fan of Linda Fiorentino in this role.
In this role.
Not as a person or an actress.
Correct.
Just in this role.
So, yeah. So Metatron gets her settled down. And I think I really appreciated what he said about he wishes he could have taken it back.
Oh, that's a great scene. Because then he references having to tell Jesus that he's going to die.
Mm-hmm.
You know. For you Catholics out there, it's a very touching story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, it was great delivery.
It adds a little bit of emotion.
Oh, absolutely. Alan Rickman was top class.
Yeah.
Top notch. Anything he did. From Hans Gruber to the Sheriff of Nottingham.
Well, did you hear how Kevin Smith got him to do the movie? Well, like what, you know, how he approached him? Because he found out that Alan Rickman was a huge Chasing Amy fan.
Oh, yeah. I read that, actually.
And got him to agree to the movie as long as, one, he didn't want the wings to be CGI. He wanted them to be actual wings. And he wanted them to stick to the script, stick to the story.
Yeah.
So I thought that was, Alan Rickman, big actor, coming in to do this movie. I was, you know, very surprised by that. Yeah.
And then Kevin Smith had to pull Jason Mewes aside because he was a big old druggie, and saying, you know, Alan Rickman's coming to set. You have to be on your A game. You have to be totally professional. Take this seriously. And, you know.
And what did Jason Mewes do to try to impress Alan Rickman?
He learned the script front to back.
Everybody's
line, and came to rehearsal that way, just to, you know, impress Alan Rickman. So that, mm-hmm. that was pretty good.
Yep.
Yeah. So we actually find out that God can't be found. So the Metatron, the Apostle, and I can't remember, Serendipity is not there, right? It's just because they're at that restaurant.
Yeah, they're at a restaurant.
So they're in the forest at one moment, and then Metatron transports them all to a restaurant. And they're talking about, you know, these guys are getting close. These angels are getting close. And if they do it, we're all, you know.
Well, here's where we connect up. In the beginning of the movie, there was a kind of a guy standing on a pier who got beat up by the three demons on rollerblades.
That's how the movie opens.
Yes. And so he gets put into a coma. We find out this was God on one of his little holidays going to play skeet ball.
Right.
And so that's where he is, but our heroes don't know that.
Bethany asks, can't God just come down and stop those two? I mean, it's God, right? And Metatron's like, yeah, but we don't know where he is.
Yeah.
And so, but he's, and turns out he's been trapped in this coma.
As they discuss it, God, if he was awake and walking, could just return to heaven, no problem, and stop them. If God was killed in human form, he'd immediately go to heaven. So they're trying to figure out what's the third option. Where is he and why can't we find him?
Right. She.
Well.
By this time, it was she.
Did
yes.
Did was Metatron referring to him as she at this point or
he acknowledges it. Yeah, Serendipity says that she's a she. And
By this point in the story, I thought that everybody was referring to as her.
Yeah, Metatron even makes it a point to go, and her, like.
Right.
You know, remember. So yeah, they are all out of ideas, and so Jay comes up and says, why don't we just go to this church and ask the cardinal to close the doors and not do this? And Metatron's response was, the little stoner actually made his profit.
Yeah, he delivered.
He delivered, yeah. So that's what they do. So they go to the church, ask the cardinal, who is played by...
Cardinal Glickman?
Played by George Carlin. It's fantastic as the cardinal. I know there's a lot of controversy around it, but... Yeah. And he plays it well. I mean, he was a great actor, a great comedian. Yeah. I really enjoyed George Carlin.
Little piece of trivia. George Carlin had recently lost his wife. So I don't know if you noticed in the scenes where you could kind of see his hands, his ring finger had a Band-Aid over it because he asked Kevin Smith if he could keep his ring on.
Never paid attention.
Mm-mm. Yeah. Me neither.
So I thought that was a little interesting piece of trivia.
Yeah.
Pretty trivial.
So they make their way to the church, ask Cardinal Glick to shut it down, and he says, nope, still happening.
And get out.
So Silent Bob, to get back at him, they steal the Cardinal's driver.
Yeah.
And so they all meet up at a bar. Serendipity comes in, but before she does that, who's at the bar waiting for him?
Azrael pops up,
and him and the apostle have words, and Azrael's like, no, we're all going to stay here and wait for the two angels to walk through the arches, get killed, you know, thus completing my plan. And he keeps them there because he doesn't want them to interfere or try and stop him anyway.
Well, let me ask you this question, and I keep going back and forth on this. Who is the big bad in this movie? Is Azrael the big bad because he's the one that's orchestrating it and pulling out all the strings? Or are those church doors that the angels are going to go through that could negate all of existence, is that the big bad?
Those doors don't exist unless Azrael gives the idea to Bartleby and Loki.
It's kind of like asking, is Thanos the big bad, or is Thanos the problem, or is the Infinity Gauntlet the problem?
Did you just want to ask that question so we could talk about Thanos and the Infinity Gauntlet?
You labeled me as the comic book guy. You know I got to bring it up.
This is probably the fifth reference in this episode, something to do with the Avengers.
Real quick, Brandon Fraser.
I wanted to say that earlier.
Take a drink. Anyway, go on.
And if you do not know what John is referring to, check it out on our website, threeguysinaflick.com.
Listen to the Crow podcast. What's the biggest problem? Is Azrael causing the problem, you know, or is the door, just like Thanos and the Gauntlet? Which is the bigger issue?
It's Azrael.
That's where I would say as well.
But what if Azrael wasn't even in the picture and the angels had still figured out this loophole?
They did not know about it until Bartleby got that envelope.
But he got the news clipping, the news article that's what gave him the idea. There was nothing else with the news clipping, just the news clipping.
Right.
What if he read that in the newspaper?
He didn't.
But what if he did?
What if the guy missed the iceberg on the Titanic? It wouldn't have sunk.
He lives.
You can't play what ifs with things immortal. Like that.
They're immortal. You don't think in the next 1,000 years... he's going to catch a newspaper article about this church or other churches like it?
Well, the church would have to be going through the same rededicating ceremony 1,000 years from now.
So that's the only time those doors would work?
Yeah.
Is during that ceremony?
Yes.
Okay, I thought that was a permanent thing going forward.
No.
Two years later, 10 years later, yeah, let's go through the doors now.
Yeah, no. No, it was a one-time.
Yeah, okay, because, well, that makes a little more sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So the big bad of the movie is, in fact, Azrael.
What do you think of this whole scene in the bar where we're setting up for kind of the final motion?
Oh, I thought it was great. Jason Lee delivers his lines brilliantly. The way they find a way to dispatch Jason Lee was great. I like when Jason Lee shoots he orders a holy bartender.
The bartender can't deliver.
And then he shoots the bartender. And we progress with the scene. Jason Lee's talking about, I'm not going to tell you my complete plan.
I'm not going to fall into the Bond villain.
Right, because Serendipity has figured it out, except for where's God? So they go through that whole dialogue, and then finally, Jay starts laughing because he's like...
35 seconds later.
He's like, holy bartender, I get it.
That's great.
I love that. So they have to, the good guys have to figure out a way to stop these angels because
they're being held hostage. At this point.
So Serendipity looks over at Bob and starts giving him inspiration, and Azrael catches on to it. He dares Silent Bob to hit him with that driver. that they stole
Cardinal Glick's driver.
Yeah. Yeah. So he does in great Jason Lee fashion, very arrogant and cocky about it, because he keeps saying, I'm a fucking demon, you know? And Bob hits him with it and immediately implodes his chest and he can't believe it. And then the rest of our heroes attack the three rollerblading demons. Serendipity tells Bethany to bless the sink.
Making it holy water.
And we dispatch the three rollerblade demons and Ezreal.
Ken, with the buildup of all of this, what do you think of this whole scene?
I thought it was very clever to have the driver be the saving piece for this.
And why was the driver the saving piece?
Cardinal Glick was arrogant enough to be somebody that wanted to have a perfect golf game. And so Serendipity pondered that those golf clubs must have been blessed by him, turning it into a holy instrument of God.
And that was the only thing that could take down Ezreal. We are back at the church. Cardinal Glick is speaking. Bartleby and Loki show up. Bartleby decides that this is a good time for them to uncase their wings.
Well, right before that, for comic book nerds like me, I loved when Ben Affleck got face-to-face with the security guard who tells him to go home. And we find out the security guard's name is...
McGee.
And Ben Affleck looks at him and goes, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Clear call out to the Incredible Hulk.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then proceeds to break his neck. Basically, we have Matt Damon, Loki coming out, transubstantiated, like, you know, right as the Cardinal gets dropped down headless onto the ground. We learn that, you know, Bartleby has completely lost it. And then we have our interaction with Bartleby coming down, giving his big speech, and Loki deciding he has to stop him.
Right. So Loki stands up to him, and Bartleby kills his friend. And it's kind of a, you know, they've spent so much time, a millennia together, and he lands up killing him because he thought he lost his faith, which is ironic. So the rest of the gang show up, and they have to keep Bartleby out of the church. So Jay picks up a gun and decides to fire it.
Well, right before that, is it Kevin Smith or was it Bethany that figure out?
Bethany.
Bethany figures out that the John Doe, because Jay mentions, you know, maybe I should, you know, it would have been better to be in a coma like the John Doe at the hospital. And Bethany figures out that's probably God. God's caught, stuck in a coma. So him and or her and Silent Bob run off to the hospital.
Right. And while they do that, Jay and the rest of the gang try to stop Bartleby from re-entering the church or entering the church.
They're getting their asses kicked.
And Jay decides to pick up a gun and fire at Bartleby and takes off his wings, making him human. And Chris Rock gets all mad at Jay and says, you just helped him, stupid. So now they're really under the gun. Now they really need to stop him, because Bartleby's plan is to go into the church. And after the police and everything are called, they see all the carnage on the ground. When he walks out, he's expecting the police to shoot him in the head, killing him, thus sending him to heaven, thus negating existence.
Now, this scene bothered me. This one, and you're usually the one, Don, who calls out scenes that don't make much sense, or, you know, why didn't they do this in this scene? They've just turned Bartleby into human. He's nowhere near the church. He's what, a good 50 yards from that door, maybe 30 yards from the door. They could have picked up another weapon or found something and just killed him, just like he just killed Loki right there and then, so he doesn't go anywhere near the church. But instead, they're just like, oh no, you've given him everything he wants. Let's stand back while he goes, walks into the church.
That builds the drama.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought about that too, but then I remembered Jay's out of bullets. Because I remember thinking, why don't they just shoot him in the head?
They could have jumped him. He's human now. He doesn't have any angel super strength or anything anymore.
Well, who are we talking about? We're talking about a billion-year-old dead guy, Jay, who's probably not that strong, and Serendipity. Ben Affleck would have just shrugged him right off.
He's
Batman, by the way.
He wasn't Batman back then.
Oh, he'll always be Batman, John.
He was just J-Lo's boyfriend.
So We cut back to Bethany and Silent Bob finding John Doe jersey in the hospital, and she turns off the life supply.
This is, to me, this was one of the most important scenes in the movie. And I'm thinking that this is the one that Kevin Smith wanted people to really think about. And do you know why I'm getting to that?
I have no idea.
In the beginning, they talk about, you know, the Catholics protesting, pulling the plug on this John Doe, that, you know, right to life and all that, it violates, you know, Catholic law, that life is precious and they need to keep him alive. But to save the world and save existence, they had to pull the plug. They had to go against, you know, Catholic religion, Catholic beliefs, and pull the plug to save all existence.
They call that ironic.
Yeah, so I thought that was kind of, to me, that was kind of the big push point of where he was trying to get people to think.
So Bethany pulls the plug. John Doe bolts out of bed like he wakes up. We cut back to Ben Affleck making for the doors. And to answer your earlier question, they're chasing him. They're trying to stop him.
That's true.
You know, so and since this is all happening at the same time, it's fair to think that they did try and stop him. So we cut back to John Doe. When his life support got pulled, Bethany got shocked and electrocuted.
Yeah, like this lightning came out of him.
Right.
And shot everything.
And we saw that she got hit in the gut and she starts bleeding.
Well, you know, the interesting thing I thought, and I didn't catch this the first time, I thought, you know, it looked like she got shot in the front. If you watch the thing, she turns around and tries to get away and the lightning bolt goes through her back and out her front.
You see the burn mark on her sweater.
I didn't catch that the first time I think I saw it.
So she's wounded, but she released God, and God shows up at the front doors of the church. Just as Bartleby opens it, the big bright light, as we all expected if God was to appear, and it is none other than Alanis Morissette. What'd you think? Alanis Morissette as God.
I thought it was okay. I mean, it was a big reveal at the time. She was popular at the time. Kind of a cute idea. I guess they had, I think it was Emma Thompson, they originally wanted to play God. And they wanted Alanis Morissette to play Bethany. But Alanis Morissette couldn't do it because of her tour schedule, but she could play the character God.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how it worked out.
What'd you think of Alanis Morissette as God?
I wish that it would have been somebody else. I get why they picked her, because she was a hot commodity at that time. But for me, I felt a little schmaltzy.
Who would you have cast?
I got to say, as soon as you said Emma Thompson, that would be really classy.
Yeah.
I would definitely go for that.
Yeah, I think Emma Thompson would have been a great God. I enjoyed Alanis Morissette. I thought it was cute and quirky and kind of a relief after this big, long journey that we just had of, you know, potentially being blinked out of existence. I thought it was a good comic relief. She can't talk to anybody. And so Bartleby opens the door. We see Alanis Morissette as God. They have a moment, and it looks like that she forgives him. They hug, and then he kind of nods and does the ugly Ben Affleck cry.
And he says, thank you.
He says, thank you. And then
he's sorry.
And God opens her mouth, blowing up his head, and blowing up his chest. And then after that's all over, Jason Mewes pops up and just starts dropping F-bombs left and right. He's looking at, what the fuck just happened? Who the fuck is this? And
he looks, Alan Rickman's line.
Quite a little mouth on him, isn't there?
God gives him a look like, yeah, you're right. And then she walks up to him and she doesn't say anything to him. And she just kind of entrances him with her eyes. And again, this is God, right? So it makes sense. It
was, little kiss on the cheek.
Yeah, and then he faints. I thought it was a cute moment. Mm-hmm. And then when it's revealed that Silent Bob is carrying Bethany back because she has been wounded. And everyone is sad, and God sees...
Fatally
wounded.
Yeah, she's dead at this point.
Oh, was she dead at the point?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Basically said that she has died.
Oh.
I think Metatron makes some comment about that's the problem with being mortal.
A martyr.
Our problem with being a martyr is you have to die.
Yeah. And then God kind of looks around and looks at all the carnage on the ground, and we cut back to our heroes, and then we cut back to God, and everything is fixed. And And then Bethany.
Then he brings in Bethany. And I love how they bring in the line from the $6 million man. He can rebuild him, make him better, make him stronger,
faster.
And then even bringing in the Karate Kid, where she claps her hands and rubs her hands.
Oh yeah. And Alan Rickman Miyagi. Even says, wax on, wax off. And so, you know, God resurrects her. And this time when she comes back to life, she is now pregnant.
Yes. And I thought it was a cute way they did it, where she says, he says, there's a lot of work ahead of you. And she goes, I know, because I'm the last Scion. And Metatron says, well, you were the last Scion. And then kind of puts his hand on her stomach and says, now this is the last Scion.
And I think this might actually be the first moment where you see a facial expression from Linda Fiorentino.
Yeah, it's in these last parts, these last scenes where I warm to her.
Yeah.
And I loved, maybe I'm jumping a little bit ahead, but I loved her interaction with Rufus at this point. He approaches Bethany and he says, crisis of faith over? And she goes, yes. And he goes, oh, so now you believe again. And what does she say?
She says, I don't believe, but I have an idea.
What do you think of that, Ken? Any thoughts?
At this point, I'm just thinking, man, this is just like the Wizard of Oz.
Fair point. They're all kind of just going back home.
Clicking the heels.
Yeah. And then they say goodbye, and that's the end of the movie.
What did you think of the ending, the way it was all wrapped up? Did it work for you?
It was a present with a nice little bow on it. We went for a two-hour ride. The story was coherent. It had a good, you know, solid plot, I thought. So the ending, it ended the only way it could have ended.
Was it just... That's what I think, too.
Good, quick ending, or could have been fleshed out a little bit more?
No, their mission was done. Okay. There was nothing else to flesh out.
The only thing I was mildly curious about is, where did Loki end up? Did he get to go back to heaven, too?
Oh, that's a good question, because he dies as a human before any of this happens. I bet you he goes to hell.
I'm sure Alanis Morissette fixed it. Although, he did go on his killing spree before going through the church, so he wasn't forgiven for his killing spree.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So who knows?
Yeah.
Some of the best moments in this movie are when he's going on his killing sprees. So, yeah. All right, so I guess that is the ending of Dogma. Let's rate this motherfucker. What do you think? All right, so our rating scale, this is the first time listening to us, we do a scale from 1 to 5, 5 being the best. We classify a 5 movie as if we were scrolling through all of the channels we have and we found this movie, we would stop and watch it in its entirety. There are other movies that, you know, you could flip through and maybe you'd watch it. Maybe you'd watch a couple minutes. Maybe you skip through it. If there's nothing else on, you would go back to it. So that's kind of where our rating scale is. I love Kevin Smith. I am a huge fan of Kevin Smith, no matter what he does. Cop Out. I loved Cop Out. Jersey Girl. So going into this, I thought that, you know, Kevin Smith did a great job writing it, and the story was, I really enjoyed the story. And as a Catholic, growing up Catholic and still being Catholic, it seemed all plausible. It raised a lot of good questions. Now, whether or not we will ever get these answers, who knows? But the point of faith is not necessarily for it to be proven to you. You just have to have faith. Right. And that's kind of what he's really ultimately saying here. And he did it in a very comedic way. The cast was fucking spot on. If I was flipping through the channels and this was on, I would definitely sit on it for a couple minutes, see where we're at. So I'm going to go ahead and give Dogma a solid 4.
How long had it been since you'd last seen it?
That is a great question. Years. Easily.
Yeah, I'm thinking... Last time I saw it was Blockbuster Video, long time ago.
Well, you know, the reason why it's been so hard to find anywhere or even see it anywhere.
Why is that, John?
Because Disney originally owned the rights to the movie, and they sold the rights to Harvey Weinstein and his group. And so during all the protests and everything and all the bad publicity, they weren't exactly sure how they were going to distribute it. And they were still trying to figure that out. And then all the stuff came out about Harvey Weinstein. And because of all of that and everything, it's been put on hold, the distribution of this movie. And Disney won't touch it, obviously. So you won't see it appear on the Disney network. Netflix can't get a hold of it because you can't buy the movie right now. You can't buy the rights. So you can't find it anywhere. It's not, you know, on Amazon, people are selling their old copies of it for tons of money. You can find it on eBay, you know, for tons of money, but you can't go and find new copies of this anywhere.
All right, you're up. What do you think?
My review. Again, just like you were saying, of every Kevin Smith movie I have seen, I have loved. I have not seen Tusk. I've heard horror stories about Tusk, but it, you know, I've seen The Human Centipede. I can see Tusk. So that's one of the movies I do want to see. I thought this was a labor of love of Kevin Smith. It's a movie he had worked on for a long time. It was a passion project. Kind of what you were talking about, you know, coming from a person of faith, I thought the message that he was conveying, and he got it across clearly, is you can be a person of faith and you could have strong beliefs, but be open to questioning things and be open to new ideas. And I thought that he really got that across clear, in that, you know, the Rufus character really kept bringing that up of, here's some ideas to think about and here's some other things that, you know, you can believe everything you believe. It doesn't hurt to also believe this or to consider this idea. And I thought Kevin Smith just did a wonderful job. The rating that I would give this is one of those movies that, just like you were saying, I'm scrolling through the channels and I see it's on, I'm going to watch it for a while. I may not watch the whole movie because there's just certain scenes that you want to catch. You know, I want to catch those Alan Rickman scenes and maybe I'm going to watch it, but I know how it ends. I'm not going to want to watch it all the way to the ending again. So I'm going to give it a 4 as well.
So for me, I've mentioned earlier that I was not a big fan of Linda Fiorentino. She took me out of the story because I was very meh about her. Matt Damon, Ben Affleck, I saw them the whole time. It's just because they're younger in their careers. They show a ton of maturity together by the time we get to Good Will Hunting. And unfortunately, I have, you know, a little bit of reservations in how Matt Damon and Ben Affleck came across to me in the movie. Another shortcoming that I had with the movie was Chris Rock. I only know Chris Rock as a comedian. And so all I'm hearing is Chris Rock, and it's not Rufus, it's Chris Rock. So I saw Chris Rock as Chris Rock. And so it was a movie for me where I am just looking at actors and I'm not looking at characters.
Sure.
So if they had picked just nobodies to play some of these roles except for Silent Bob and Jay, if they had picked nobodies, you might have enjoyed it more?
Hard to say, because, I mean, I'm in love with Selma Hayek. Mm-hmm. And
it's a given.
I adore Alan Rickman, but you know, they were more effective to me in their delivery of their characters. Their characters were much more believable for me than Loki and Bartleby and Bethany and Rufus. In general, it's an okay movie and I am indifferent about wanting to see it again. Yeah, I might watch it if I were to surf into it for a couple of minutes, just like you guys. But I would give it a solid 3.
3. All right. Time to pick the next movie. Who's up?
I guess I will be picking. The way that we do this, for anybody who has listened to our past shows, is when we started this little podcast project, we all put 5 of our favorite movies into a Broncos helmet. Now, I do want to bring up that so far, we have picked, 5 of Don's movies?
All. I am all out of movies.
He is out of movies. We have picked 3 of Ken's movies,
which I would consider in his top 20.
We have picked how many of my movies?
That would be 0.
So we've picked 0 of my movies.
Goose egg.
And what really sucks is at first I thought you guys were playing me a little bit, but even when I reach in, and I could see there's plenty of movies left in there, even when I reach in, I don't even pick one of my movies.
Yeah.
So let's see if I can pick one today.
I am highly curious to see what your 5 movies are. I think I know one of them for sure, but I'm not.
You're going
to
get all 5 of mine in a row. I'm going to love it.
85% chance of getting one of your movies, John.
And we have picked my first movie.
Oh, fantastic.
Okay.
The movie we are watching and reviewing this week is Flash Gordon.
And that's exactly what I thought was, that's what I was going to say. I said, I think I have an idea, and it was fucking Flash Gordon.
It is Flash
Gordon. Outstanding.
The classic cult film.
1929. We're going to do the black and white original.
No.
You son of a bitch.
We're doing one with the one with the Queen soundtrack.
Okay, so that concludes our episode. You've been listening to Three Guys in a Flick. This is where we review the good, the bad, and the absurd.
Will Thanks. Flash Gordon be absurd?
Oh, I hope not. All right. Have a good night, everyone. We will talk to you next week.
For anybody who is listening from anywhere that's not our website, we have a new website up, which is just threeguysandaflick.com. You can do it with just the number three or spell out three, but threeguysandaflick.com.
Frustration. I'm the nuclear bombs if they're to hit.